Did you hear about the classroom walkout in McPherson, Kansas, back in January over the implementation of online curriculum? If not, let's get caught up. A couple of school districts in Kansas have started using something called Summit Learning, which is kind of a radical concept in education and one supported by big thinkers in Silicon Valley, including Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg and his wife Priscilla Chan, who are backing the initiative. Well, as Kansas schools have rolled out the program, some parents and students have been really disappointed by it, and it's created something of a rift between schools and families. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're going to start today's show by getting a clearer grasp on what Summit Learning is before we dig into the bigger questions it raises about technology and education. My first guest is the superintendent of the Wellington Public School District, Mark Whitener. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is Summit Learning? How does it work? Can we establish that first and foremost?
Sure, absolutely. So Summit Learning is an online platform that is customizable. We're able to upload curriculum into it. And for our viewers, one way to think of it is in years past, teachers created lessons on paper and they kept those lessons in files. And today we have digital platforms that allow us to upload lessons and resources into a digital format. And so certainly Summit has done an amazing job of preloading resources for us. For instance, they use Khan Academy resources and a variety of resources that teachers have used for years and years, and those are available on the online platform, and our students can access those resources as they're going through the curriculum.
So can you describe what a classroom looks like where this is being used?
Absolutely. So one of the components of our redesign, so Summit is a component of Kansas redesign. It's a component of our district's redesign or personalized learning. It allows us to do personalized learning. But when students go in, teachers may be doing a short lecture, and then students may be working collaboratively. So we may see a group of students doing a Socratic seminar.
But when you say doing a Socratic seminar, can you describe what that looks like?
So the teacher will be leading a discussion. Students have read some text or have done some research, and then students have almost a debate around a topic, but not as formal as a debate. So students are discussing the content, and the teacher is guiding that discussion. You also might see a teacher working with a small group of students. So students may be grouped. When I've done walkthroughs, I walk in and teachers have grouped students based on some skills that students need help with. And so the teacher is sitting with them and doing a small group lesson and guiding discussion around a specific topic. So you see a lot of collaborative work that's going on, and students are doing research, and teachers are guiding that process.
They're doing it on tablets. Lecture. They're doing that research on tablets and doing the lessons on tablets.
So research is done digitally instead of hardback text, but that's not really radical. Schools have been doing that for, you know, over a decade. Some schools have been doing it for, you know, 15 years. So certainly our students have access to digital resources.
Have you been, I guess I wonder why your district chose to implement this program. What's your hope for it?
So I had mentioned that one element of Kansas redesign is personalized learning, and the platform allows students essentially to work on the skills that they're missing. And so part of their day, not a huge part, but a small part of their day, could be them working on an online platform on specific skills that they're missing. Another part of their day is project-based learning, and the teacher is leading the projects. For instance, our students produce a TV show. Our students run a school store. Our students do marketing and supply marketing for different businesses. And so project-based learning is part of that. And so when students have an opportunity to work on some of the skills that they're missing at their own pace online, that frees up the teacher to do the small group instruction that I mentioned, and it also frees up the teacher to work on project-based learning. And through project-based learning, we're really working on critical thinking skills, we're working on higher-level problem solving, and we're working on collaboration. And
can I jump in quickly? I have a question about something that you've said, which is you're talking about freeing up the teacher to work with small groups. What is the average class size in your school district?
In the entire school district, the average class size is about 20. Our class sizes are larger in the high school, probably 27 to 30 is the average size. In the high school, when they're working with small groups, they're probably working with 5 to 7 students.
Can you tell me more about the Wellington Public School District, the unique challenges you face there as you try to serve this community? Because I'm trying to figure out how this curriculum fits into the larger picture of this community and this learning environment.
That's a great question. So this is my third year in the district, and we have looked really closely at our achievement data, and our students perform significantly below students across the state and even neighboring districts that have very similar demographics. Our ACT scores are below the state average and below the national average. Our state assessment scores, historically, the last few years have been significantly below the state average. 30% of our students that go to university have to take remedial courses. Our parents have told us, and I've had parents specifically tell me, that their A students were flunking out first semester of college because they weren't prepared. And so one of the things we've tried to do with redesign and through Summit Learning is to increase the rigor of our instruction and expose students to, as I mentioned before, the critical thinking, the problem-solving skills, and the collaborative skills.
What made this the way to do that? Were there obstacles that you were facing that, in terms of just looking at local on-the-ground resources, were not available to you? Or out of reach in some way?
You know, so one of the things I'd mentioned is really working with students in smaller groups. And we know the traditional model, when we think of the traditional school model of students sitting in rows and columns, and the teacher gets up and gives the same lesson to every student, regardless of where the student is in their learning. And then the next day, the teacher teaches the next lesson. And so when you have a personalized learning piece, students are able to work at their level, and if they're missing skills, they're able to get that backfill and get those skills filled. And then the teacher is able to, as I said, work with small groups of students and figure out the skills that they're missing and meet their needs instead of just teaching to the middle as the traditional model has always done.
Have you been pleased with how this is playing out in your district's classroom so far?
I have been very pleased, and I've done walkthroughs every week, and the level of instruction that's going on in our classrooms has increased significantly, and it's some of the best instruction that I've seen, and this is my 35th year. I'm seeing kids not sitting and sleeping in classrooms, which my first year here, as I did walkthroughs, I saw kids disengaged and not participating, and now kids are working collaboratively, they're talking, they're interacting with the instructor, and it's some of the best instruction that I've ever seen. Our teachers that are working at the high school have commented that this is far better than anything that we have ever done, and they are experts. We have hundreds of years of experience in our teachers. They are experts, they're amazing folks. They're highly educated, they're curriculum specialists, they have master's degrees, and I'm really proud of the work that they've done and our administrators. They're experts, and they've done an amazing job.
Okay, Mark Whitener, hang on with me a moment. I want to bring in another perspective. Tom Henning is a parent who has been so opposed to what's actually happening with this curriculum that he pulled his child out of a public school in Wellington. And now he's part of a campaign to end what might be seen as an experiment. Tom Henning, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You didn't start out with the position you have now. Your strong feelings against Summit Learning happened kind of gradually. Can you tell the story of your journey with all of this?
My son had approached me maybe 2 to 3 months into the school year and asked if he could transfer, and I was kind of shocked. I didn't know why.
How old is your son?
He is 16.
Okay.
And so when he started explaining how he didn't like the new curriculum, I kind of just told him to tough it out. You know, I didn't really look into it, didn't ask the questions. I just said, you know, tough it out. You're going to have jobs you don't like in life, and just suck it up. And, you know, it started having kind of an emotional drain on him. He's one of those kids that gets up super early, just loves to go to school. He would go to school year round if he could. And he just became almost lethargic. He'd come home and just be depressed. And so I started talking to him a little bit more about what he didn't like about it. As I started researching the platform and the privacy concerns I had with it, I made the decision to, according to the Summit contract, you could de-identify your student by removing his personal information, and they would still use the Summit platform. The school district told me that if they de-identified him, that he couldn't use the Summit platform, and the only choice was to transfer him to another district or take the GED program. So at that point, we made the decision to transfer him.
Can I pause and ask you more to say more about your privacy concerns?
Well, there's 44 pieces of information that are shared with the Summit platform, which is essentially Facebook, and they're just information that you really shouldn't need to know to educate a child. You know, for instance, the child's place of birth. Why does that matter? There's some of the stuff we chose not to share, such as the student's bus pickup location. Again, I'm not sure why Summit Learning would need to know where your child gets picked up for the bus.
Can you tell me more about your son's concerns? Because although I like to imagine that a 16-year-old wants to transfer schools because of abstract concerns about privacy, I imagine there was something more immediate for him.
It really came to me when, you know, when I told him, he had asked me again at the Christmas break if he could transfer. And I said, you know, he's very active in sports. And I said, you realize you're going to lose 18 weeks of sports eligibility if you do this. And he says, I don't care. I don't like it. And for him to give up his sports, athletics, that was a big shocker that he hated the platform so much to give that up.
What do you think he hated about it?
As I talked to him before we made the transfer, he had, you know, he mentioned that he couldn't get mentor time. If you had to ask the teacher a question, there was a line after class. They didn't really have the time in the class. He had met with his mentor. Now, the Summit platform guarantees 10 minutes of mentor time a week. He had met with his mentor 5 times in the 20 weeks, I believe, he was at the school system. Kids, there was a little girl that cried in class sitting next to him. So there was a lot of depression in the students, just the feeling of hopelessness that he couldn't, you know, he didn't like it. He was surrounded by negativity, and that kind of pulls you down.
You have a sign that you've painted. It is up in front of your office, I understand. It says, "Don't plummet with Summit." Tell me about this slogan, and because it sounds like you've been engaged and activated against this beyond just your own personal choice to remove your son from the district.
Well, we're fortunate. We have the resources to send Toby to another school district. There's parents that don't have that. Obviously, he's not bused. He has to drive himself, or we have to take him. There's parents that aren't fortunate enough to have an extra vehicle, or just because of their jobs, they can't. So we kind of banded together to fight for the kids that can't transfer.
Talk to me about the range of parents' concerns. When you say you band together, what are you hearing from concerns perhaps other than the ones that are motivating you?
It's everybody has the same complaints. We started having weekly parents meetings. We had some pretty good turnout at some of them, you know, 40 to 60 parents. It was all the same stuff. The privacy, the lack of education, the, you know, my son just flat out told you, he would tell me he didn't feel like he was learning anything. And there was the feeling of hopelessness that the kids were behind. They felt they were behind. They could never catch up. They couldn't get time with their mentor.
When you spoke earlier about telling your son, tough this out, you're going to have jobs you don't like, you're going to have to work through situations you don't enjoy that you think are less than ideal, something must have changed. You must have had some moment where you crossed the threshold from tough it out to I can't stand by and watch this. Do you remember what that was?
Yeah, it was when he asked me, or, you know, was willing to give up his sports eligibility. That hit me pretty hard that he was willing to do that. And that's when I really started researching. I'll be honest, I wasn't a good parent. I didn't really dig into what he didn't like about it when he first said he didn't like about it. I just, you know, told him, just tough it out. And then as I seen the emotional drain on him and as it drew on, it kind of hit me, if I had a job that I hated that much, I'd find a different job.
So what do you think of the superintendent's description of the program? You know, what do you think that it was missing? Because clearly that doesn't entirely match what your experience has been. So I guess a little bit of how it works in theory versus how it works in practice from a parent's perspective.
I think he described what the ideal scenario is, but in reality, the teachers aren't spending the mentor time. And maybe they are now. You know, my kid's been at a different school. Maybe they've revamped that. But even when he was still there, they were bringing substitute teachers in on Wednesdays just so the teachers would have time to get caught up approving projects. On a project Toby did, he had waited, you know, sometimes weeks to get approved to go to the next project.
So it sounds like the idea of freeing up teachers with this project-based learning has maybe also had the unintended consequence of increasing the number of different projects teachers are keeping up with, which doesn't free them up at all.
Absolutely. If you have one teacher teaching one lesson plan, like Mark had stated, that's all you have to focus on if students have questions on it. Well, if you have 30 students on 30 different subjects or areas, you have to bounce around. You're all over the place.
Let's bring Mark Whitener back in on this. Mark, what are you feeling listening to Tom's story? Surely this is not what a superintendent wants to hear.
Well, certainly I appreciate our parents' perspectives. I had invited Mr. Henning to come in and sit down and share his concerns with me, as I had with all of our parents, and had a couple of parents take me up on that and come in and sit down and tell me their concerns. And as parents have come in, and certainly as you start anything innovative, it's always difficult in the beginning. Teachers are learning a new program. Students are learning a new program. Mr. Henning hasn't taken that opportunity. I know our high school principal has invited parents in to walk through classrooms so that they could see for themselves what's going on in classrooms, and I don't think Mr. Henning has been able to do that.
Can I jump back in and ask you to address this very specific issue of whether teachers have actually been freed up and whether students are getting one-on-one time with their teacher or really direct contact with their teachers?
So certainly during the regular class period, students have contact with the teachers, and when we walk through and when we take parents through, they can see that teachers are working with students as they always have. Students aren't on 30 different projects. A class has one project at a time when students are doing their project-based learning, so the teacher is able to focus, and certainly I would not try to tell anybody this has been perfect. We have worked through a lot of issues. Our administration has a parent advisory group that they've sat down with. They also have a student advisory group that they've met with on a regular basis, and they've made adjustments. We've tried to make adjustments for our teachers so that they can do that mentoring time. The interesting thing about it is The complaint was that students aren't getting enough mentoring time, but in a traditional school model, students get no mentoring because students are in a classroom about 48 minutes, and then the teacher gets another group of students that move on.
Well, Mark Whitener, superintendent of Wellington Public Schools in Kansas, thank you for these insights. I know you have to get back to superintendenting, but we appreciate your time. Parent Tom Henning, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
And good luck to your son.
Thank you.
We will be back after the break with a former teacher who tested a beta version of Summit Learning in his classroom and an education researcher with ideas about the tensions playing out over all of this. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about a new online curriculum being used in some Kansas classrooms. We're curious about your perspective. If you're young enough that screens and technology and the internet were part of your own school experience, tell us what you think. Or if you're a parent or grandparent observing the changing landscape, do you have questions or concerns? 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That's 816-235-2888. Let's turn now to Kyle Palmer. He is KCUR's morning news guy, author of the Early Bird newsletter, and also a former teacher. He just so happened to test an early version of this curriculum that's been put in place in Kansas in his classroom. Kyle Palmer, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Gina.
Can you give kind of a recap of your experience with Summit Learning?
Yeah, to back up, so I was a teacher in California in Silicon Valley at a charter high school in the Summit Public Schools Network, which is now Their founders have branched off and now founded Summit Learning, the online learning platform that you were talking about in your first segment. And about 5 years ago, Summit Charter Schools piloted a beta version, if you want to call it that, of what has now become Summit Learning. And very interesting listening to the conversation between the administrator, the superintendent in Wellington, and the parent, because that very same dynamic played out in that year that we piloted that early version of this platform. I think on one hand, great enthusiasm and optimism about what so-called personalized learning could do for a classroom and for teachers and students. But at the same time, once you got to on-the-ground implementation in classrooms, a lot of anxiety and confusion. And
for whom? For the teachers? For the students?
For all involved, just because it did pose a very different norm from what you might be used to in a classroom. And
what was so different about it? Because from the superintendent's description, he really made it sound to me like this isn't so different.
Right. Yeah, and I would agree with that to an extent. I think the biggest thing that, just thinking back to that year, the most frequent criticisms I heard from parents and students, and not all parents and students by any measure, but the most frequent criticisms I heard were just the amount of time that they were expected to sit in front of a screen during school hours, and the amount of independence that they were given. I think made a lot of students uncomfortable. On one hand, you could look at that and say, well, that's a good thing. You were trying to push students to be more independent, which was, in fact, kind of like the founding idea behind why they wanted to do Summit Learning, to prepare kids for college and independence after high school.
Sort of self-starters.
But I think a lot of students felt like maybe they were thrown into the deep end of the pool without getting a lot of cognitive or intellectual supports before they were given that. So we had study hall periods and different types of times throughout the day where they were expected to kind of sit in front of a Chromebook and look at resources that were given to them through the online platform, which again at that point was still very new and nascent and being constructed as we were using it, and be able to learn something, take a quiz, and be able to then use that on more cognitively demanding projects later in the unit.
We've heard some different takes on what this looks like to parents versus administrators. What was it like from the teacher's standpoint? What are some considerations that non-educators might not even think about?
Yeah, it was interesting talking to students that year because it brought out a different side of a lot of students, students who you might, in good and bad ways. So students that you might not have expected to really take to the program or really show independence, once they were given that rein, shined and did well and did improve their performance. Then you had other individuals who had been very successful in the mode of school that they were used to, being asked to look at a playlist of resources. We call them playlists. So look at a playlist of resources and then learn on their own and kind of put together information before doing something in class. Made very uncomfortable by that and then saw their performance plummet.
What about this psychological piece of it? We heard this parent saying that his son reported that there was someone crying,
so how he described it, it really took me back to that year we piloted this, because the type of like visceral emotional reaction that he was describing in his son, I saw that frequently. Now, again, not every student, and I wouldn't even say most students at our school of about, 250, 300 students, were able to kind of muddle their way through that year. But the type of visceral emotional reaction that his son that he's describing had, I saw that a lot from students.
When I think about Silicon Valley and this sort of entrepreneurial mode of thinking that you hear about coming out of there, this word disruptive comes to mind. And that is exactly what this sounds like in both the good and bad sense, as you were saying.
Yeah, there was a book written in 2008 by a guy named Clayton Christensen called Disrupting Class or Disrupting School. I can't remember the exact title, but it had disrupt in the title. And that's kind of like a Bible for ed tech evangelists in Silicon Valley, if you want to put it that way. They still look back at that idea of flipping the classroom, is another phrase you hear a lot, where teachers are freed up to do more. You can kind of envision a classroom that looks a lot like, Plato's Academy, where people are just kind of sitting around and talking and discussing and having high-blown intellectual discussions about things. We don't have to spend so much time on test prep.
Looking at pictures of cats?
Well, so then that's where the rubber meets the road in actually implementing a system like this, where you give all kids one-to-one technology. Inevitably, you're going to have kids looking at cats or much, much worse, in my experience.
What is it, beyond the disruption concept, what's your sense of why Silicon Valley likes this model and seems to be putting money and effort behind it?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. I mean, having lived out there for 3 or 4 years, it's just in the air there. I think there are all different kinds of industries where Silicon Valley thinks the next big idea is going to change the way we look at that industry. And education is just another of those industries. There is certainly something about education that not only are you, it's kind of like it's not a two-edged sword. That's the wrong metaphor. But I mean, not only is there a great opportunity to make a lot of money, but there's also a great opportunity to really feel good about yourself by doing something in education. And so I think that's why education is particularly attractive for people in Silicon Valley, because you're going to make a lot of money, but you're also...
Where is the money-making opportunity?
Well, when you sell these curriculums and these platforms to school districts or to charter school networks, there is an opportunity to make a lot of money. So that was not my end when I was teaching at Summit Public Schools. I think, and by Silicon Valley standards, the ed tech space is not as lucrative as other spaces, for sure. But I think, there's so much optimism. It's just in the air there that you feel like you could. Having lived out there and been a teacher in that environment, it's hard not to at some point start to believe it.
We're gonna come back to Kyle in just a moment, but I want to turn now to Jane McManus. She's joining us from KU, where she teaches teachers how to integrate technology into their classrooms. Jane, hello.
Hello.
What have you been hearing in this conversation?
So much. There's so much here at play. I work with teachers day to day who, they struggle with this. They struggle with, how do I integrate technology effectively? How do I make my superintendent and my principal happy with me? How do I also make the parents happy with what I'm doing? And so there's this struggle back and forth of, technology's exciting. We love technology. We want to use it. The students seem to love it. So there's that initial excitement.
It's also very hard to take it away, which I would think that can feel like a value in it, in that you're going to have to fight an uphill battle to keep kids away from it. So is there a piece of that too, like just embrace it?
Yes. There's the piece of, we are in the 21st century and these are our 21st century learners. This is the digital generation. And so if we don't use this, we are missing an opportunity to engage them. So we want that high engagement. And that's a really great thing to have. the problem, it really enters in when someone doesn't stop and think about things. You know, stop and think about not just what we want to do with this technology, but how are we doing it? And really, my focus lately in creating the virtual learning network at KU is to discuss, how are we doing this? And then also, why?
What are some of the different answers you're getting to those questions? How and why?
You know, it depends on who you ask and who the stakeholder is. You know, it's one of those things that the 21st century skill set, you hear the superintendent talking about that. It's very important. Critical thinking skills, collaboration, the higher level thinking, all of that, and increasing the rigor with this redesign. That's a really great thing to try to do. But it's the how do we get there?
I'm curious about why online curriculum answers a question about rigor in a way that an on-the-ground teacher, not that there isn't a teacher there, but that a traditional learning model cannot. Because we've seen rigorous education before this, right, the advent of the internet.
Right, right. Well, and my background really began in traditional education and schooling, and there's a lot of rigor there. What we're trying to see with technology is how we can increase the rigor through personalized learning. But that is a buzzword, as you have been discussing here. And you have to remember, yes, we can do that by having adaptive software, by having dynamic software like has been promised here. But it has to be done in a thoughtful way. And there has to be some transparency with that. You know, and the thing that I struggle with when you talk about personalized learning is you have to remember the person in that. So, and that's not just the student, it's also the teacher, it's everybody involved. You know, if you take
explain
the person
what that
out,
means a little bit. What, how is what we just heard maybe failing to account for the person?
I think it depends on who you ask here, because there are different parents with different feelings on this. But when you look at the parental concerns, you know, they have valid concerns, and everyone here has valid concerns, and those are, and somewhat based on these fears of changing from a traditional curriculum to a not so traditional curriculum. Those fears are certainly understandable. They need to be addressed, but they are valid fears, because if you're taking away the instructional time between a teacher and the student, then you are missing that human interaction. When I taught online, I had live synchronous classes at the secondary level. That was key to kind of supplementing, and not even just supplementing, it was the heart of my online teaching and instruction. So, you know, we can't just say it's either or. There has to be a middle ground where we are able to say, you know, you can't forget the pedagogy here. You can't forget what it means to teach.
I'm trying to just imagine myself in the student's position and understand what is both anxiety provoking in some cases about this new model and exciting for some other students. And I could imagine both of those things. I could imagine on a top, I struggled in math. If you had put me in front of math resources by myself, yes, I would have been in tears. Absolutely. Because I needed help. I needed a lot of help. Whereas if you had put me in, I basically did a low-tech version of this in learning a language because for a lot of reasons. But I really thrive just getting set in front of the materials and doing language learning on my own. I think it might not even be as simple as one student thrives and one doesn't. I mean, even from subject area to subject area, I would imagine myself being both versions of this kid.
Right. And it also depends on the content within one subject area. There are certain things that you can teach face-to-face, and there are certain things that you can teach online. And, you know, I think this is so much in its infancy still that there's not been a lot of research about this, and there needs to be, to discover, you know, what can we do with these tools? What should we do? You know, and maybe there are certain things, like you said, with language that worked for you. You know, there are certain areas we can do this with, but maybe there are others we need to kind of hit the pause button and take a look at it.
What are the real underlying issues that this particular experiment is getting at and maybe revealing, that's sort of an undercurrent in conversations around education right now in general?
You know, in general, I think there is a desire to redesign things. And that's outside of education as well. You know, I've worked in other industries where that is a big thing. With redesigning, it's very exciting. It gets your attention. It gets your focus back in. And
this is going to be completely different.
Yes. And it can be a really wonderful thing. I have been on projects where you can see the redesign. It was much better, the end product, than it was before. And you can see that. But to do that, you have to really do it thoughtfully. You have to stop, take a look at what actually needs to happen and why. And also take a look at the research and what does it tell you about this, instead of just jumping and going for it. I mean, that's exciting. And we do it in certain ways, but there are times where you have to slow yourself down or a team down and say, let's take a look at all the stakeholders here and let's take a look at what our end goal is.
Kyle, when you think back to your experience, when you think about the challenges that students had in school and that you had as a teacher, did this online curriculum get at any of those, or was it more like symptom addressing than underlying problem addressing, if that makes sense?
I think what Ms. McManus said really resonated with me about the speed and pace of change, and I might be answering your question in an indirect way, but one of the problems that I remember, one of the things that students said most often was, I don't learn by computer, which I think was an indication to me that they felt they were being thrown in front of a computer without enough resources or supports from educators like me or the school in general.
That the tool was becoming the content.
To feel successful. And yeah, and like we were doing it for the sake of having computers. That's at least how a lot of students interpreted it. And the underlying philosophy and theory behind why we were doing it, I don't think was ever made clear enough to enough students to be able to really bring them fully on board and get them on our side, so to speak, in the reasons why we were making the changes. And that bled over to the staff too. I mean, I think even from the top down, the change was made swiftly for us too. I mean, like my first year teaching at this school, we were, which you might consider more traditional. Over the summer, we had a few trainings, and then boom, in August of the next year, we were doing this. To varying degrees of fidelity in each classroom. They never mandated it for each teacher, but there was the expectation that we would use it in some way. And then that just got more and more prevalent as the year went along. So it was quick for us, too, as teachers. And so the students, not all the students were bought in, and not all the teachers were bought in as well, and that affected our implementation of it.
When you think about the students who did thrive, mm-hmm. is there something that if you were still in the classroom today, whether you were using a tablet or a textbook, that you would be carrying with you in a positive sense from that lesson?
I think what it did teach me as a teacher was that, I think I already knew it, but it underlined for me again that students are multifaceted human beings who are going to be successful in a number of different ways of learning and in modes of learning. And the one thing that I think it was valuable in that experience to learn was that the traditional model of how we do education does not work for all students. And so just as we maybe are trying to plug students into this personalized learning hole, at the same time, for decades or centuries, we've been trying to unsuccessfully plug a lot of students into the traditional classroom structure as well, and that has not been successful for all students.
Kyle Palmer, KCUR's morning newscaster, host of the podcast No Wrong Answers, I appreciate you stopping by.
Yeah, thank you.
And Jane McManus with us from KU, thank you so, so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll have something entirely different, a mom of NASCAR. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Angela Ruck is a race car driver. She's the only person actively competing in NASCAR who is also a mom, and she'll be racing here in Kansas City tomorrow, just as Mother's Day weekend begins. So naturally, we need to talk to her about that work-life balance as a mom who is a leading woman in NASCAR. Angela Ruck, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So tell me about your love of racing. How did this begin?
You know, well, so for my passion for racing, it started when I was a young girl. I was 9 years old. I got a go-kart for Christmas, not really knowing what it was or break from throttle. And obviously racing has been in my family. You know, my uncle, Daytona 500 winner in 1990, Derek Cope. My dad was a racer. My grandfather was a racer. So, you know, my family just wanted to bring us up in something, keep us busy out of trouble. And little did they know that it would grow to this passion and this dream of what I'm doing today. So
when you look around you at other NASCAR drivers, you're the only mom. How many other women are there?
So there's three of us women out there now.
And that is not a lot.
No, it's very little, right? Compared to how many drivers are out there, like between the trucks and the Cup Series, probably like 150 drivers. So it's incredible to be one of three. And then to be a mom on top of that, a new mom, it's the most incredible thing in the world.
How did you think that you might have to make a choice between having a family and doing NASCAR?
You know, I catch a lot of like negative and positive from feedback from fans and stuff. And to me, it's like, why can't a woman do everything and be great and win at everything? Successful women do it every day. They're raising babies and they're, you know, successful at their job. And it's the only way I want to do it.
It's funny because I am sure that plenty of the other drivers are dads, and I don't suppose anyone's asking them that question.
Well, I think they obviously have it a little easier being, you know, at least their wives will be back in the hall, back in the motorhome taking care of their children. I think that's where it's a little bit of a struggle for me is, you know, having him at the racetrack with me and, you know, my husband's having to do that job, or it's trying to find the balance there of who's going to do it while I'm out on the racetrack, you know, driving 200 miles an hour. That's where the stress comes in, but I have, you know, a great team behind me that helps me and, you know, helps me manage my schedule. So we all together work as a team.
Forgive me for not being super, like, knowledgeable about NASCAR.
Yeah, that's okay.
I think of it, although it is using a tool, a car, I do still think of it as being fairly athletic on some level. And I'm curious about the experience of being pregnant and being a NASCAR driver. This is something I think about in part because when I was pregnant, I drove in a normal car, but I like reaching your wheel and hitting the pedal are hard. And I realize, yes, your experience with motherhood has not followed this exact path, but that intimacy and the logistics behind the really like physical aspect of both what you do as a mother and what you do as a driver, that's still at play.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. You know, I'd say, you know, obviously doing what we do, driving a cart, you know, over 200 miles an hour, it's physically demanding on us. You know, you do got to be, you know, got to go to the gym. You know, that's a full-time job for me. And then also, you know, good thing I adopted a baby, so I didn't have to, you know, go through that part of it. So I'm still able to do what I do on an everyday basis, but also juggle the adoption process with the birth mom at the time. But it was an incredible experience.
Yeah, the danger of it, is that something that makes you nervous as a parent?
You know,
I won't
say
as a mom because that should apply to dads.
You know, I get
as
that
well.
Question a lot. And actually, I didn't really have to think about it till just recently when I had, you know, I wrecked out at Texas pretty hard in the wall. And I had to really, you know, take a step back and be like, wow, you know, I have a baby now and there's other things to worry about besides just myself. But in the end, I think he'll grow up knowing that his mom, you know, is very passionate about what she does. And I'm here to win when it's all said and done. And he'll grow up to be proud of me one day. I know that.
What is your ultimate goal as a driver?
To be the best out there. I mean, obviously to win. Not. I can't necessarily be the top, to say to be the top female, but there's only three of us. So that's not really, in my mind, saying a whole lot. I got to be honest with you.
That is saying a whole lot because it's against the two other bests.
Yeah, but there's only three of us, right? So let's just be real. When it's all said and done, obviously I want to be number one. I want to win. So that's what I'm out here doing. And as I'm sure all the other females want that for themselves as well.
Do you think that there are, just in any culture where you're one of just a few, there can be this sense of having an extra hurdle to get past? I wonder if you experience that or if you just keep focused on what you're doing and there is no extra pressure, no extra issue.
Well, I think there's always pressure on you when you're one of very few females in it, trying to, you know, earn the respect from everybody out there, your competitors, also, you know, NASCAR itself is, you have a lot to prove. You really do when it's all said and done. You want people to respect you. You want people to know that you deserve to be out there. And it's tough to get that. But you just got to keep kind of digging. You can't give up. You know, it's negative things always come your way, but it's what gets you over those negatives that makes you a lot stronger in the end.
in parenthood, when you talk, when people talk about juggling parenthood with whatever career they're doing, it gets talked about sometimes as though the specific career you're in doesn't sort of shape what that means, but it does. I mean, for example, for me, if I'm going to be live on the air at a certain time, then something that comes up sort of spontaneously in the morning, like sickness, that's a different picture for me than for someone whose job maybe what time it happens could be a little flexible or something like
that. Yeah, that's been a struggle for me is like, you know, I'll have a set plan to be at the shop to do this, and it never, you know, unfortunately falls into that category in that time frame that I need it to, unfortunately. So I've been learning to juggle my time and my schedule. And, you know, again, it's like I have a great team of support that helped me, you know, that, you know, my little man got sick this weekend and he was supposed to be here with me. So that's stressful. So it's the first time leaving him at home. Aww. And it's a lot, you know, and you get your focus is your job. So I got to focus on this tall task I have on me tomorrow. And it's getting through that. But also, you know, being on my phone and just making sure he's good. You worry as a mom. It's so tough.
Do you think that being out here doing interviews like this, in your mind, does that increase the possibility that someone might see that there is a path to making it possible?
Absolutely. I love doing these appearances. I love being, you know, sitting here with you having this conversation and just kind of telling my story. I need it, right? That's just putting yourself out there and letting people know your story. And, you know, that's kind of why we're filming, you know, I'm sure you heard of the reality show that my husband and I filming, The Rook Life. We film our life. It's kind of like a documentary and we're just trying to tell our story. And the journey is that I sell all my real estate to give it a big shot in NASCAR, all the while, you know, trying to adopt a baby and going through that process.
When you talk about The Rook Life, though, what does that mean to you? What is it that happens behind the scenes in your life that you think, like, people need to understand this?
Well, it's what I love is it's us, and it's at our home, and it's real life. It's the struggles that we go through with adoption. You know, it's not all roses. I thought it would be, but you'll see, you know, we had 3 failed adoptions. So you're going to see all the raw emotion of that. You know, the cameras are interfaces literally 24 hours a day, especially when you don't want them to be, right? Capturing those moments that you're just like, you want time to yourself, but you can never get it. So just kind of telling our story, you know, how tough it was, the adoption process. But in the end, you know, it's so rewarding. And then also trying to be a mom and trying to juggle, you know, trying to make it to the race shop on time, trying to create a baby to the shop if I have to bring them. It's real life struggles, right?
How do you work in a race car shop with a small child? That sounds really hard.
You know, it I will say it is.
I mean, even just having a small child in a kitchen where there might be a knife somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, it is stressful when I think about it. There's the first week I brought him home, I had to be at the race shop the next day. And so I'm like, oh my gosh, I have to take him. So I get him in the car once I figure out the car seat struggle, but got through that. But they're, you know, I just signed that 12 race deal with Nice Motorsports. So I wasn't sure how they would take it, me bringing a baby to my first, you know, my first appearance at the shop. But they were all great. You know, they all have kids of their own. So they've been there. They're really helpful. So it's awesome.
Tell me about tomorrow's race.
I'm super excited. So I've been on Kansas Speedway numerous times. I love the track. I love the fans. I'm just excited to be here.
What does this race mean to you?
This is what I love to do, so obviously I'm very passionate about it. Of course, I wish my little man was here with me, rooting me on, because it always makes me smile.
How old is he?
He is 2 months today, and he is growing so fast, and it makes me sad, but at the same time, I'm just so excited to see how he grows up to become his own little man. So I'm just loving every minute of it. I'm loving being here in Kansas for the weekend, big weekend ahead. We need a top five finish this weekend, so.
What is your favorite thing about racing?
My favorite thing.
Is there like a specific aspect of it that just nothing else could fill this role in your life?
You know what it is? I think I love the feeling of just jumping in that truck and knowing that it's like me in the truck and just giving it my all. It's pretty incredible. And everything relies on you at that point. You know, the guys do a great job at the shop preparing the truck and giving me everything I could possibly have to go fast and to get a great finish. But then to know that when it's time and I got to get out there, you know.
What are you like as a driver on the regular street?
I drive crazy. My husband hates driving with me, but at least I know I can get us there safer than he probably could. So,
Angela Rook, thank you so much and good luck tomorrow.
Thank you so much. Be sure to follow us on The Rook Life on Instagram and Facebook.
Angela races at the Kansas Speedway tomorrow night, green flags at 7:30. She is the only mom in NASCAR so far. That's a wrap. You can listen back to either of this morning's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow is a food show celebrating the season. A local chef will help you find creative ideas for mint and rhubarb. We'll go from to a chicken farm that supplies a lot of restaurants here in the city with meat and eggs. And we will get the latest in Kansas City's restaurant news. That's tomorrow at 10 on KCUR's Central Standard. Talk to us on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Stay tuned.